This is day five of this November 2013 seven-day session. And I'm going to read from and comment on the Platform Sutra by Wei Nung. It's been many years since I've done this. And maybe what prompted this was coming across a relatively new translation of this by Red Pine. Red Pine is the name this translator goes by. I'm going to start by reading from a different book, The Golden Age of Zen by John Wu. Here he has a whole chapter in this book about the Golden Age of Zen. Refers to the Tang Dynasty and its masters. And he has a whole chapter on Wei Nung, the sixth patriarch. He says here, he is assuredly one of the superlative geniuses that China has ever produced. He belongs in the company of Laozi, Confucius, Mencius, and Chuangzi. His sermons and conversations, as recorded, collected, and printed by his disciples under the title of the Platform Sutra, constitute the greatest masterpiece of Buddhist literature of Chinese authorship. It's no accident that in the whole Tripitaka, that is all the sutras and commentaries and other things, this little volume is the only Chinese work which bears the title of a sutra. Another one that is not attributed to the Buddha is the Vimalakirti Sutra. All the others are attributed to the Buddha. It's generally recognized that Hui Nung is the guy who gave Zen its character. It's Zen as we know it really began with Hui Nung. Bodhidharma we consider the founder of the Zen school. But the texts that we use, the teachings, are really stamped with the teaching of Wei Nung even more than Bodhidharma. This short sutra begins with it's him sitting before his monks. And it begins with him relating his own story, his short autobiography. So here we are. Master Wei Nung took his seat in the lecture hall of Ta Fan Temple to expound the teaching of Maha Prajnaparamita and to transmit the formless precepts. Seated below him on that occasion were more than 10,000 monks, nuns, and lay people, along with Magistrate Wei Chu of Shao Chao and more than 30 officials and 30 scholars. Together they asked the master to explain the teaching of Maha Prajnaparamita. One of the really interesting things about this translation is that Red Pine interposes, if that's the word, he mixes in with his own translation the other translations that are out there. There's quite a lengthy introduction to this in which he explains that his translation is based on the Platform Sutra that was found in the Dunhuang Caves in northwestern China in the early 20th century by this famous British archaeologist by the name of Stein, I think Arnold Stein. Stein took a caravan deep into the to the Gobi Desert and then returned to England with hundreds and hundreds, thousands maybe, of sutras and figures, all kinds of Buddha figures and other remarkable things. The caves of Dunhuang are, because they're situated in that arid climate, they had protected, the dryness of the desert had protected these sutras from the 7th century. So it was one of the most extraordinary archaeological finds ever. Some would say he plundered all of this, and where much of it sits now in the British Museum. But another way to look at it is that during the Cultural Revolution, 1966 to 1976, when the Red Guard, Mao's henchmen, went wild all over China, destroying Buddhist temples and figures and sutras, they were safely tucked away in the British Museum. So Red Pine makes the case that this, because he's working from these ancient documents found in the Dunhuang Caves, his translation is more reliable than the translations we've been using up to his translation, which were based on later copies of the Platform Sutra. So one of the differences he points out here is that this 10,000 monks, nuns, and lay people, he says that the later copies from which other translations were made have it as 1,000. So seems a little 10,000 seems like an awful lot at this monastery, but there's. Records also show that Wei Nung's own monastery, that as far as the resident monks, there were 1,150 of them. So it's conceivable that on that particular day they had 10,000, you know, a lot more guests, but it's a little hard to believe. So together they asked the master to explain the teaching of Mahaprajnaparamita. There are a whole slew of texts that collectively are known as the Mahaprajnaparamita Sutra. And two of the most famous of them are the Diamond Sutra and the Heart Sutra. What we chant each day in our own Prajnaparamita is just a very, very shortened, abbreviated version of one of the collection more broadly known as the Mahaprajnaparamita Sutras. It continues here. The magistrate then instructed the master's disciple, Fa Hai, to make a record to pass down to future generations so that students of the way who carry on its guiding principle and who transmit it to others might have this testament as their authority. When he spoke this platform sutra, Master Huainong said, "Good friends, purify your minds by reciting the teaching of Mahaprajnaparamita." Then the master stopped speaking while he purified his own mind. This statement, good friends, literally the phrase is companions of virtue. And when he said purify your minds by reciting the teaching of Mahaprajnaparamita, Red Pine says that this may have been just that final gatha. Gatte, gatte, para gatte, parasam gatte, bodhisvaha. And it says why he purified his own mind. The translator comments, Huainong begins this teaching in silence as if to recall the tradition that began when the Buddha held up a flower. I do this before Taisho, as we all know. There's a moment of silence where I'm purifying my own mind, letting thoughts settle. And then it says, after a long time, he spoke again. Good friends, please listen. And then he begins with his autobiographical account. And this too is a tradition that is common in Buddhist sutras to have an account of the significant events in the career of a bodhisattva prior to their Buddhahood. So he says, my kind-hearted father was originally from Fanyang, but he was dismissed from office and banished to Lingnan and lived in Xunchao as a commoner. My father died when I was quite young, and my widowed and destitute mother moved to Nanhai, where I experienced hardship and poverty and sold firewood in the marketplace. Here I'm going to be reading different little nuggets from the translator, his own notes. He says here that it's odd that Huainong refers to his father as kind-hearted, especially since he barely knew his father. Usually this phrase is reserved for mothers, and more normally the father is referred to as the strict father, kind-hearted mother, strict father. And Red Pine says his father's offense must have been serious, though not so serious as to incur the death penalty. So he was banished to the south of China, and where Red Pine tells us it was often tantamount to a death penalty, as few northerners survived the tropical climate and its diseases. About him selling firewood in the marketplace. I'm losing my place here about that. I'll find it. Oh, yeah. In Chinese society, the woodcutter and the firewood seller were often viewed as intermediaries between the mundane and the sacred worlds. By the way, Wei Nung was born in the year 637. Red Pine tells us that his father probably remarried or added another woman to his household relatively late in life. And he suggests that his mother was a member of one of the ethnic minorities in this region. He says that it was not unusual for a prominent family to fall from favor so quickly that the children of the succeeding generation lived impoverished lives. But for the son of an official, even a banished one, to grow up illiterate was, as it would be today, rare. Still, it is an attribute, that is, his illiteracy, that Wei Nung himself insists upon throughout the sutra. After all, his educated father was not alive during his childhood when he would otherwise have been taught to read and write. And it is possible that literacy was not considered important by his mother, especially if she could not read or write. Other writers have suggested that Wei Nung's illiteracy may have been a sort of a way of backing up the emphasis in Zen on seeing beyond words. But we'll never know. It's too long ago for us to know for sure whether he was illiterate. Then one day a shopkeeper ordered a load of firewood brought to his store. After he took the delivery and paid me, I walked toward the door and met a customer reciting the Diamond Sutra out loud. As soon as I heard the words, my mind felt clear and awake, and I asked the man, "Where did you get this sutra you're reciting?" He said, "On Huang Mei County's East Feng Mao Mountain in Chicho Prefecture, when I was paying my respects to the fifth patriarch, Master Hung Zhen. His congregation included more than 1,000 disciples. And while I was there, I heard him tell the monks and lay people that just by memorizing the Diamond Sutra, they would see into their natures and immediately become Buddhas." And now, this is Wei Nung still speaking. "As soon as I heard this, I felt drawn by something from a past life. I said goodbye to my mother and left for Wang Mei's Feng Mao Mountain to pay my respects to the fifth patriarch, Master Hung Zhen. The Diamond Sutra, the two primary themes in the Diamond Sutra is formlessness and non-attachment. This is the fifth patriarch's temple is the one that they have residents, records show as having 1,150 monks in the 7th century. So he gets to this Huangmei mountain and finds Master, the fifth patriarch, Hung Zhen. Master Hung Zhen asks me, "Where are you from? And what exactly do you hope to get from me by coming to this mountain to pay your respects?" So this is the opening move by the fifth patriarch to take the measure of this very young monk who probably had, his eyes were shining from this experience he had in the shop after hearing the Diamond Sutra, part of the Diamond Sutra recited. I answered, "Your disciple is from Lingnan, a commoner of Xinchao. The reason I came all this way to pay my respects is I want to be a Buddha. I don't want anything else." So here he is, standing before this towering figure, the fifth patriarch himself, and he comes out with this clear statement of aspiration. The master scoffed, "But you're from Lingnan and a jungle rat as well. How can you possibly be a Buddha?" Okay, about that jungle rat. The Chinese character literally means dog hunter, that is, someone who hunts with dogs. The expression was somewhat more forceful than hick or hillbilly and indicated membership in one of the hill tribes in South China. So it was some kind of a non-Han Chinese ethnic group. And he says here it's quite possible that Wei Nong's mother was a member of one of these ethnic groups, and that Wei Nong arrived at the monastery wearing clothing that suggested such an affiliation. Well, now we have to say that this was a test. The fifth patriarch knew very well that this young man was equally endowed with Buddha nature, just as much as he was himself. And he wanted to see how this insult, really what it was, how Wei Nong would react to this. It's a classic form of testing in Zen is to insult the person and see if they get defensive. But Wei Nong stood his ground. I replied, "People come from the north or south." "People come from the north or south, not their Buddha nature. The lies of this jungle rat and the masters aren't the same, but how can our Buddha nature differ?" The master was about to say something more to me, But when he saw his attendant standing there, he didn't say anything else and sent me to join the Sangha workforce. A novice then led me to the milling room where I peddled a millstone for more than 8 months. In another translation, they said that the fifth patriarch was afraid of giving Wei Nong too much attention in front of these other monks, and perhaps that would be another test to send him off to the back 40 of the monastery to labor there and see if he was up for the task of being a monk. On one of my pilgrimages to China, I saw this stone. The translator says, in addition to peddling a stone wheel, Wei Nong wore a stone around his waist to increase the force of the milling. The waist stone is also still there. In another translation, the one that is maybe familiar to most of us, after Wei Nong comes back and says, "Look, we're all the same in Buddha nature," has the fifth patriarch saying, "This jungle rat is sharp. Don't say anything more. Go to the stables." So I went outside and proceeded to the rear of the monastery. After more than 8 months, the patriarch suddenly saw me one day and said, "I thought your views were worthwhile, but I was worried that someone might become jealous and harm you, so I didn't say anything more. Did you understand?" I said, "Yes, I understood. And ever since then, I haven't dared go near your hall to keep from attracting attention." And then Red Pine's translation continues. One day, the fifth patriarch suddenly called all of his disciples together. After they had assembled, he said, "I've told you that the greatest concern for a human being is life and death. But you disciples spend your days making offerings, just looking for ways to reap merit and not for a way out of the bitter sea of samsara. If you're blind to your own nature, how can you find the doorway to merit? Go back to your rooms and look into yourselves. Those of you who are wise, make use of the prajna wisdom of your own nature. Each of you write me a gatha, a verse. When I read your gathas, if any of you understands what is truly important, I will give you my robe and my dharma and appoint you the sixth patriarch. Hurry, as if there were a fire." We don't know what prompted the fifth patriarch to want to stage this test, or that is, what would prompt him to be looking suddenly for a successor, unless it was Wei Nong's arrival itself. But it may have just been that he was aging to the point where he could see that he needed to turn it over to someone else. And this phrase, just looking for ways to reap merit. Merit is another word for good karma. Making offerings, you see even to this day, people in China offering incense, but not just a stick of incense, but big bundles of incense that cause great clouds of incense smoke. Presumably, they're thinking that if you offer a big bundle, it's more merit than a single stick. And when he says, make use of the prajna wisdom of your own nature. Really, to say prajna wisdom is redundant. Prajna really means our transcendental wisdom that is common to all of us. Literally, the word prajna means what comes before knowledge. What comes before knowledge? This is our innate wisdom. It has nothing to do with learning, memorizing, study. It is our wisdom we were born with. It is our wisdom that we carry with us all through our lives, and what we can awaken to. There's a little note here. Go back to your rooms. Red Pine tells us that senior monks had their own rooms, while junior monks usually shared a room, and novices lived in dormitories. And the size of a room was usually less than 10 feet square. It included a bed, a footlocker for clothes and books, and a low table for writing. Usually would not include a chair. People normally sat on straw mats or cushions. Having received these instructions, his disciples headed back to their rooms and said to one another, there's no need for us to clear our minds and trouble ourselves about writing a gatha to show the abbot. The venerable Shen Shu is our precept instructor. After he receives the Dharma, we can look to him. Why should we write a gatha? So they all stopped worrying about it, and no one dared to submit a poem. This is such an interesting little bit in this sutra. They all want to beg off. They see Shen Shu as their mentor, precept instructor means that he was in charge of instructing novices in the precepts and the texts that dealt with deportment. This may reflect the tendency that some people have, even today, of abdicating responsibility for their own awakening. Many people, although they have convinced themselves that they want to come to awakening, still they harbor a seed of doubt about whether they could do such a thing. Seems so formidable, so rare. This is a great, great obstacle. Doubt, this lack of belief in oneself, faith in oneself. And it is to the practice, the zazen, that will eventually dissolve that doubt, and one grows into it until one is ready, the mind is ripe. But so long as one is thinking, oh, I'm just, you know, I've got all this heavy karma and my mind is so clouded with thoughts and I can't seem to get anywhere. Well, as long as you're thinking that, then you'll be hindered. It continues, at that time, in front of the Patriarch's Hall, there was a 3-section-long corridor. Because people left offerings at the foot of the wall, the abbot wanted to cover it with scenes from the Lankavatara Sutra and paintings of the 5 patriarchs transmitting the robe and the Dharma as a record to be passed down to future generations. The painter Lu Chen had inspected the wall and was going to begin work the following day. Red Pine surmises that based on that old measure, a 3-section-long corridor, there's about 30 feet long, this wall. So here we have this wall. It's about to be painted, and this is a chance that the 5th Patriarch sees a chance to have any monk in the monastery write out his understanding on this wall that is about to be painted. At that time, oh, excuse me, I already read that. The Venerable Shen Shu thought, no one is going to submit a mind poem because I'm their precept instructor. But if I don't submit one, how can the patriarch tell if the understanding of my mind is deep or not? It would be right for me to show the patriarch a poem that reveals my understanding as long as what I wanted was the Dharma. But it would be wrong as long as what I wanted was the patriarchship. I would be no better than a fool who thinks he can usurp the position of a sage. But if I don't submit a mind poem, I'll never receive the Dharma. As he considered this, he kept thinking, what a predicament. So he won't let himself, have the ambition to become the 6th patriarch, but he wants the Dharma. It's an interesting kind of convoluted thing he's going through here. There is a bit we have here on this Shen Shu. He grew up in North China in a family related to that of the emperor. He became a monk at the age of 20 and was known for his learning. After he heard about Hung Zhen, the 5th patriarch, he traveled to the monastery and was so impressed he decided to stay. Accounts differ as to when he left. Some say he left in tears in 662 and went into hiding for over 10 years. In any case, he built a hermitage outside that monastery. And after a number of years, his fame reached the empress, who invited him to court, and he spent the rest of his life in the capitals, lecturing to audiences that sometimes numbered in the thousands. So he did all right by himself after coming out on the short end of this test. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Finally, at midnight, without letting anyone know, he went to write his poem on the middle of the south corridor wall in hopes of obtaining the robe and the Dharma. He thought, when the patriarch sees my gata and reads these words, if he comes to find me, the moment I see him, I will tell him I wrote it. But when he sees my gata, if he says it's not good enough, it will be because I'm deluded and the obstructions of my past karma is the obstruction of my past karma is too great, and I'm not ready to receive the Dharma. The master's mind is impossible to fathom. I may as well stop worrying about it. So the venerable Shenshu held up a lantern and wrote his gata on the middle of the south corridor wall at midnight, and no one saw him. And this was the gata he wrote. The body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is like a standing mirror. Always try to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust. Just a little bit of details here. Until fairly recent times, mirrors in China were made of bronze. Most of them were small enough to hold in the hand, but here he's using this as a metaphor for the mind, having it on a stand. The metaphor of a mirror as the mind really goes back to Taoism. Xuanzi once wrote, "The realized person uses their mind like a mirror, neither anticipating nor welcoming anything, responding to everything, and retaining nothing. Such a person is thus able to succeed in all things and remain unharmed." Now let's consider this verse that he wrote. The body is a Bodhi tree. Okay, so far so good. The mind is like a standing mirror, right? Always try to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust. Well, it's all right as far as it goes. He's giving advice to practitioners of the Dharma that you work, you do daily zazen, to maintain the luster of the mind, to keep thoughts from collecting and darkening the mind. Okay, it's all right. After Shenshu wrote this verse, he returned to his room unseen and lay down. At dawn, the fifth patriarch sent for the court artist, Lu Chen, to come to the south corridor to paint scenes from the Lankavatara Sutra. And then the fifth patriarch suddenly saw this gatha. He read it, and he told the court artist, "You've gone to so much trouble and come so far, we will pay you 30,000 cash, but we won't need any images now. The Diamond Sutra says all images are illusions. It would be better if we kept this gatha for deluded people to recite. If they rely on it for their practice, they won't fall into the three unfortunate states of existence, and it will be a great help to anyone who cultivates the Dharma." So he found a reason to send the artist away. This 30,000 cash, Red Pine does his scholarship investigation here. He calculated that 30,000 coins would have weighed about 200 pounds. And he says the size of the payment apparently reflects the inflationary crisis of the 670s. You see, I have this image coming up. Roshi used to talk about he was in Germany at the end of World War II after it ended, and seeing these people wheeling wheelbarrows full of banknotes through the streets with a terrible, terrible inflation. But he needed to, according to the account, he needed to keep that wall undecorated by the artist. And it's a good thing, because then the Wei Nung, the sixth patriarch to be, uses it, and we'll have to pick that up in tomorrow's Teisho. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.